Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What do we call Monday? We call Monday Rethink the Week. When do we tape Monday? Of course, Friday morning. We've begun our show on many, many occasions with installments from Ann Nelson's fabulous piece at the Washington Spectator. It was entitled Project 2025, The Latest Plot Against America. We're actually up to installment number 10. And what Ann points out is that Project 2025 is actually the opening salvo of the 2025 presidential transition project. And she notes that it's a comprehensive 900-page playbook. It was produced under the auspices of the Heritage Foundation and supported by over 100 partner organizations. It's actually officially entitled The Mandate for Leadership, The Conservative Promise. Project 2025 lays out specifics for hundreds of policy objectives affecting every area of public life. Many of them affect three primary areas. First, the dismantling of environmental regulations, clean energy measures, and climate policy. Second, a rollback of civil and political rights for women and LGBTQ populations, and the elimination of public health measures. And finalmente, a massive purge of career civil servants and the concentration of power in the executive branch and the White House to consolidate an entrenched authoritarian regime. Here we are up to number 7 of the 10 things you need to know about Project 2025. Project 2025 calls for the concentration of powers in the White House. The chapter on the White House office was written by Rick Dearborn, formerly Trump's deputy chief of staff. The chapter on the Department of Justice also calls for the expansion of presidential powers. It was written by Gene Hamilton, who formerly served in Trump's DOJ. He is in the general counsel of the American First Legal Foundation, co-founded by White House advisor, no shock, Stephen Miller. And Hamilton calls for the conversion of the FBI into a political instrument of the president. Quote, the next conservative administration should direct the Attorney General to remove the FBI from the Deputy Attorney General's direct supervision within the department's organizational chart and instead place it under the general supervision of the Assistant Attorney General for the National Security Division as applicable. Such a structure would place the FBI under a politically accountable leader with fewer things to manage than the Deputy Attorney General or the Attorney General. Translation, there will be lawsuits. But with an army of White House lawyers and the FBI acting as a White House security force, these can be dealt with. Anyway, just to let you know, as you sort of go through all the pieces that she has offered us in her Project 2025, and then you hear the interview in Time magazine with Donald Trump, a two-part interview, it is both terrifying, but clearly it picks up from Project 2025, and a lot of what you read in that document and what you hear in his answers in the Time magazine article, they are parallel experiences. And of course, the scary thing about Project 2025 is it doesn't even need Donald Trump to get elected in order for it to begin to happen, because we see versions of 2025 happening all over the United States in places like Florida, places like Iowa, places like Oklahoma, and of course, Texas. Joining us right now for a Rethink the Week is our fabulous panel of guests. We have Professor Adam Finkel. He's a clinical professor of environmental health sciences at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. His research, writing, and advocacy focuses on a variety of occupational health problems and environmental contamination. I want to welcome Adam Finkel to the program. Thank you so much for doing this, Professor Finkel.
Always. Thank you.
Lincoln Mitchell teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University. He is the author of 8 books, and his writings have appeared at CNN, Reuters, New York Times, NBC, and the San Francisco Examiner. And if you want to read more of Lincoln, you can subscribe to his Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln. Welcome back, Mr. Mitchell.
Good to be here, Arnie.
Laura Jadid is a freelance journalist who primarily focuses on the American conservative movement, which means she's working 24/7. Her bylines include New Republic, Rolling Stone, and the New York Magazine. Welcome back, Laura.
It's always great to be here, Arnie.
All right. And of course, finalmente, Stephen Pepere is a professor of public policy, Vermont Law and Graduate School, author of 4 books, including his most recent book, Politics for Social Workers, A Practical Guide to Effecting Change. Welcome back, Stephen.
Thank you, Arnie. Good to be here.
So one of the things that was interesting as people were reacting to the Time magazine article about Donald Trump, which was clearly terrifying, but not surprising. And again, if you had read anything from the Project 2025, it literally is exactly out of that playbook. And how far he would go is in some ways not shocking. But one of the things that really sort of surprised me was when he said, Trump says it's up to states whether to punish and monitor women for abortions. And when you monitor women for abortions, that means you're monitoring pregnancy. And I'm thinking, oh my God, like, how would you do that? What does that mean? And the limit of where you can go with this is so incredibly terrifying. And as I was mentioning this just before we went on the air, Lincoln, you pointed out that we've actually seen countries do this in the past. So why don't you refresh our recollection as to which countries were doing it and what was the sort of point of it?
Yes, and I would just note that while we have seen countries do in the past, these are not countries that we think of as waving the banner for liberal democracy. I was thinking specifically of China. When the one-child policy first started, so this is a different economic and social context for China, at least in the urban areas, and there, many people lived in what were in Chinese called danwei, and in English you might translate as work units, which were you would work, let's say, in a factory, and there'd be a housing area next to it. And the women who worked there, I would say, you know, of certain age, their menstrual cycles were tracked. So if they were late, that might mean that they were pregnant, and they would have their a conversation would happen. And or this was in service of the one-child policy. And of course, it's a different technological era. Obviously, this is before apps and smartphones and everything like that. But the point is, I think we, and again, like I brought this up because I've studied China. I'm a middle-aged white guy, right? Like this isn't, you know, so I have limited expertise here, but, and it's not limited personal experience, but this means this is extraordinarily invasive because yes. You're not just saying, hey, I see a baby bump there. You're saying, what's your menstrual cycle? You're seeing, you know, you were late and now you're, you know, I don't see the bump 2 months later. I mean, you can imagine just how extraordinarily invasive this is. Now, my hope is that at the end of the day, it's just not practical. But given how we know that these tools, and to go back to China for a second, that the new technological era has given us, how invasive they can be, how powerful the surveillance state can be, I think it is practical. And I want to say, you can either claim to be the party of freedom, or you can model policy on a communist dictatorship. I don't know how you can do both.
So the other girl on the panel, Laura, got to step up here, honey. Because one of the things I read is that this is from the Washington Post article. Former President Donald Trump said in an interview published Tuesday that he would not intervene in state decisions on abortion policy, including in situations where states seek to monitor women's pregnancies and prosecute those who violate abortion bans. But in a lot of ways, Laura, he's a little bit like Pontius Pilate, because when they sort of asked him, would he be comfortable with states prosecuting women for having abortions outside limited periods permitted by state laws, his answer is this. Oh God, he's so Pontius Pilate. It's irrelevant whether I'm comfortable or not, Trump said. It's totally irrelevant because the states are going to make these decisions. So, you know, he takes credit for it with the Supreme Court. Then when he is asked questions about it, he gets to sort of wash his hands and say, well, you know, all I did was provide them an open door. And if states want to walk through that door, it's totally fine with me, as if somehow he has no position on this, except as extreme as states want to go, there's nothing quite as extreme as anything that he would think that he needs to step in or stop, because after all, he has ceded this question to the states, and that was really his job.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's such a cop-out, and it's the only one he can do. I mean, Trump's in a terrible spot, which I love for him, by the way. This is a tremendously unpopular issue. Nobody wants the, it's destroying the Republicans at the polls. It destroyed them in 2022. I think it's going to destroy them in local elections in 2024. All Trump can try to do is thread this needle by saying stuff like this, where he can't come out against abortion. The evangelicals will lose their mind. He can't come out for abortion either, because it's tremendously unpopular. So this is, I mean, he's punting. He's punting to states' rights. Punting. I do want to say, really quickly, going back to this idea of monitoring pregnancies, this is de facto criminalizing pregnant mothers. You are treating pregnant people as potential murderers.
Yes.
And in almost every culture ever, motherhood has been revered. Producing children, the ability to create life, has been revered. Now, I don't have children. I don't plan to have children. I'm very grateful to the people who do. I think it's an incredible thing to do. And there is something so profoundly perverse about treating women or people who get pregnant, who bring life into this world, as potential murderers. It is sick. It is sick. It is not pro-family. And I don't understand how anyone can look at these people and say that they're for the wholesome nuclear family, this 1950s vision, when they treat women like criminals.
I don't know if you know this, but on my Facebook page about 2 or 3 days ago, Laura Jadid, this is what I pointed out. Trump is threatening violence if he loses. He has already accomplished that. Dobbs' decision is a form of violence against women. It is violence against, and so Adam, you're a public health guy, you have a daughter from IVF, you're looking at all this, and this touches you personally in so many ways because you look at your daughter and realize that that may be one of the things that'll be limited. But I want people to hear what Laura just said. I want them to realize this is about violence against women, because you're absolutely right. The idea that every woman who's pregnant now is threatened is basically potentially a murderer. That's what it isn't about creating life. It's about being a potential murderer. Nobody has ever said that until I heard you say that, Laura. So I'm so grateful. But Adam, this I where are the men? I guess I'm going to say this. Where are the men? I mean, because this whole situation doesn't occur because of parthenogenesis. It's going to still require a sperm, which means that men need to step up. And the question then becomes, what is ultimately their sense of responsibility, their role in this, whether they want to have future workers, whether they want to have children? I mean, if, let's not even talk about the family. Let's talk about who's going to work in your freaking factory. I mean, who's going to take care of you when you get old and you go into a nursing home? I mean, we have to start looking at this. Not only do we need children, but look what the threat is doing. And we just did a story, I think it was this week, where we were talking about how many women are now looking for permanent contraception, who are now talking about tying their tubes, not because they don't want to have children, because they feel like there's a gun to their head, as you just heard Laura even say, that pregnancy is the potential for being a potential murderer. Well, I don't want to have to run that risk. This is so bad for every aspect of society. I'm sorry, Adam, it just makes me shake.
Yeah, and I don't know where men are. I mean, the men I know are outraged, and the women I know are outraged. And I think Lincoln first said it maybe isn't practical, but I think what they're talking about is eminently practical. It is testing the gestational age of fetuses who miscarry, who are miscarried, or who are aborted. And to see if it violates, some black letter thing about it has to be 6 weeks or 8 weeks or 12 weeks. And of course, in New Hampshire, thankfully, since the last time we talked, this bill went down, but we had a 15-day gestational age abortion criminalization, which is pre-pregnancy. It's treating, it's
Yes.
basically, the Ring camera is on in your shower. If you shower after intercourse under the Carrie Gendro regime, you may be a murderer. So it's beyond disgusting. And again, as I've said every time, it's profoundly anti-life. We brought life into the world through science, which some fringe cultists think is unnatural or an abomination or something like that. And we're past that age, but we would just put our head down and say, come and get, you're going to take our daughter away out of my cold, dead hand.
Yeah. So Stephen, but the other thing I keep thinking about is that, you were listening to Lincoln talking about China and how we have now we have this new technology that allows an even greater level of invasiveness. I mean, let's be honest here. So when you go back to pre-Roe and now post-Roe, because of what's happened with the Dobbs decision, it is a totally different world. These judges have no idea, I think, really the Pandora's box they were opening up, because it impacts women in ways and impacts society in ways that they could not have understood. Because when they were doing Roe v. Wade, life seemed to be a little more simple, And now when you realize what is so complicated about how our access to healthcare, what we're able to do, how we're able to track people now because of social media, the weapon that they have now handed to the MAGA crowd and some of the extreme conservatives in government is a million times more terrifying.
So let me see if I can't connect a couple of things going back to where Lincoln kicked off this conversation in thinking about past practices in China. If you are listening to this program on Monday, it's now 2 weeks ago that the House and Senate passed as part of its Ukraine and Israel aid bill, a requirement that the Chinese company that owns TikTok
TikTok.
must either sell it to a U.S. investor or shut it down, right? And this is not my particular area of expertise, but I've been reading a little and listening to people who do know something about this. And the critique that I hear most frequently about that is that the problem is not TikTok per se. The problem is much broader, and the whole range of applications that each and every one of us has on our phones that to varying degrees allows different companies, US owned and foreign owned, to track our behavior online and monitor what we are doing from day to day. And I have, over the course of the last couple of years since Dobbs, heard any number of advocates urging women who are or may become pregnant not to use devices that they own in order to search for birth control, not to use them to search for access to abortion, not to do anything that could allow state entities to identify them as someone who might be prosecuted. So, one solution to both of these problems is not to use the new Cold War. Both left and right seem to be interested in ramping up against China to target that single company, but actually to start putting more pressure on Congress to create actual policies, some of which could be modeled on existing policies in the EU, the European Union,
Right.
that more broadly limit the ability of private companies, whoever owns them, to readily and easily track our behavior and sell it to other entities. That is, I think, part of how we build this into a much larger agenda that can tackle some aspects of both of these problems.
It's so funny when you were talking about that you had a lot of organizations are recommending to women not to use their social media accounts, not to use their cell phones, and if they're going to access things like, the morning after pill or whatever it is, not to disclose this information, okay? Because it's too easy to track it. And as you were saying this, you know what was coming into my head? I am so grateful for libraries. I am so grateful. We have to connect it to that, which also explains the war on libraries, okay? Because it is the one place where actually you are safe in so many ways, because you can go in and use those computers. You can go in. It's not personal to you. It is the public thing. And you don't even have to put your information in if you need to just ask questions, get answers. I mean, the library becomes so important. We see it as a place where it's so important for those that are like that are low income, that don't have access to the kind of technology you and I have. But if they go to the library, they get access to that technology. But now, in a lot of ways, it might be the only place that you may be safe, or frankly, it makes me suddenly understand. I love my envelope and my stamp. The idea of sending something through the mail as opposed to using technology. And the proof of all of this, Lincoln, is who never really left the record or used cell phones or internet the way we did? Donald Trump. Donald Trump did not want to let anyone know what he was doing. He let everybody else, do their emails. Let everybody else do that. But he did not want his fingerprints anywhere. If anyone was aware of the understanding of what his technology would tell about him, it was Trump. And that's a lot what we're learning actually in the trial. Everyone keeps saying he's stupid. No, he's so highly sophisticated. He's corrupt. I don't like him, but he's not stupid. He's incredibly sophisticated, Lincoln.
So this is kind of an extraordinary thing that you raised libraries just now.
I know.
And I'll tell you why, which has little to do with the show, but just like on a personal level. My father had no money, no money. And I'm not exaggerating. People say that, but when he died, I had to pay for his cremation. Like he had no money.
Okay.
And he loved libraries his whole life. I remember when he was in his early 80s, we walked into a library in a small town in New York and we were suddenly started whispering because you have to whisper in libraries. And I looked at him. I said, Dad, no, these young people, they don't even know you're supposed to whisper in libraries anymore. And then to make it even stranger, today would have been my father's 90th birthday. Mm-hmm. And then to make it even stranger, his younger brother, with whom I'm very close, just called 10 seconds ago as you were wrapping up your question. So there's a lot of cosmic strangeness going on around libraries. But I, you know, in about 10, 15 years ago, a guy named Yevgeny Morozov, who was a Belarusian immigrant to the United States, wrote a book called The Net Delusion. And this was in the early days when people were still celebrating how Facebook was going to set us free. Think back to around 2011, 2012. Right. Oh, and what he said from his experience was that this is a surveillance tool. And he talked about in the old days of the Soviet Union, if I had, you know, Solzhenitsyn or someone like that, a Gulag Archipelago, I could read it. And if I got caught with it, they could torture me. And if they got information, all they would know is the person who gave it to me and maybe the person who I was going to give it to next. Now they know everything.
I know.
And I think this is particularly, you know, again, as an old man, I only have so much expertise. But if I think of what life of a young woman who is potentially getting pregnant is like, they're so much more online than people my age that the surveillance is even stronger. And you spoke about libraries, which I could not agree with you more about that. I want to add two more things. Oh. In San Francisco, where I do a lot of research, so I go to the public library, the main branch, which is a fantastic library, not least because for many years, punk rock legend Penelope Houston worked there. But when I go there, in addition to the great research, that's where many, many unhoused people go during the day.
Yeah.
And despite what you read, despite what Fox News wants to tell you, many of these men and women, what they do is they go to a librarian and they ask for a newspaper. And the librarian, because they do not believe poverty is a crime, give them, in some cases, the New York Times, some cases, the local paper. And then this man or woman sits there, and I've seen this with my own eyes, mm-hmm. for 3 hours, feeling like a human being, feeling like not everyone's looking down at them, reading the paper newspaper from cover to cover. And those librarians, I'm not a religious person, but as some religious people might say, that's God's work that they're doing. And I want to add something else. When you go to a library, you can read books. You can sit there in the library at the desk, read a book, and no one knows what book you are reading.
Exactly.
So there's a lot to be said for if you want to stay away from the surveillance state, read books, not just the ones that Stephen and I write. Read all of them.
Oh my God, Laura, we're going to come back to you, but as I'm thinking about it, I'm a kid from New York. Okay, I was raised both in Brooklyn and Long Island, and when I was a child, there was a song that they used to sing on the air. It was like a PSA, and the PSA was, I can't believe I'm going to do this. There's a place for you and a place for me. It's local public library. They have books and things that they lend for free. It's the latest. It's the greatest. It's the library. And Laura, I want that back. I want that song back. I mean, I am 70. I remember that song. The most important thing in my family's life was when my brother, who was only about 18 months, was still in his little stroller, goes in and my mother says he wants a library card. And the woman's looking at the stroller and she says, well, he has to identify letters. So she looks at my brother and my brother goes, READING. And the woman goes, oh my God. And my brother got the, like, you know, it was the youngest person. But these are the things we don't celebrate, Laura. These are the things that we really need, and we need to protect, especially in light of the book bans, especially in light of what you're seeing happening by state after state, where they're either threatening to close down libraries or ban books or threaten librarians or even threaten them with felonies. It is so unbelievable because it's a constant war. We saw it with the war on CRT. We see it with the war on DEI. We see it with the book banning. And now, frankly, what we're seeing on campus is a continuation of the war on public education and higher ed. And I think we have to start connecting those dots for people so they understand this is synergistic. Each piece they touch impacts another. And if we don't protect each one of them, we're all losing, Laura.
The conservative position at bottom is that everything that you need to know, either depending on your flavor of conservatism, either is from the, you know, the founding fathers and whatever has been handed down, or the Bible, mostly the Bible at this point. And anything that isn't those sources is a threat. That is what corrupts the youth. That's the real corruption. It's not pornography or the existence of gay people. It's knowledge. It is knowledge of the outside world. That is what corrupts. That's why they hate college. That's why they hate all of it. from their perspective, they're just destroying what makes us human.
All right, we're going to go to a break. I think, Laura, you may want to reconnect just because I think there's a problem with your connection. But more importantly, when we come back, we're coming back to you because I want to start talking about what did the U.S. campus protests mean for Joe Biden in November. So I want you to think about that. All right, everyone, this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We call it Rethink the Week, and we will be right back.
Can it be a crime to sleep in a city park at night when you have nowhere else to go? I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. And that question was recently argued at the Supreme Court in a case that arose in Grants Pass, Oregon, which has some 600 unhoused people, no public homeless shelter, and an ordinance that first fines and after that issues trespass orders with criminal penalties for sleeping in the park. At the high court, lawyers for those persons facing criminal sanctions argued that they would be punished unconstitutionally for their status of being unhoused. They rely on a 1962 Supreme Court case that held that while a state could punish a person for possession, use, or distribution of a drug, punishing a person solely for their status of being drug dependent is cruel and unusual punishment. Likewise, the status of not having housing, they say, cannot be a crime. Also, it's hard to wrap your mind around how criminalizing not having a place to sleep makes any sense. Of course, the point is not necessarily to make them go to jail. The point is to make them go somewhere, somewhere else. But, as Justice Sonia Sotomayor asked at oral argument, if every city, every village, every town passes a law identical to this, where are they supposed to sleep? A decision is expected.
It's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history, when your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, all the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance, when you know for many people this will be their last chance, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to call it Rethink the Week, and of course we continue to tape it on Friday morning. We're rejoined by Professor Adam Finkel, a clinical professor of environmental health sciences at the University of Michigan School of Public Health, Lincoln Mitchell, who teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University, Laura Jadid, a freelance journalist who primarily focuses on the American conservative movement, and Stephen Pimper, professor of public policy at Vermont Law and Graduate School. So I promise I'd come back to you, Laura. And I have three headlines in front of me. One of the headlines is, what do the U.S. campus protests mean for Joe Biden in November? Thousands of students have rallied for Palestine after hundreds of thousands of Democrats declined to vote for Biden in the primary. And then, of course, you also have this interesting one. Eric Adams under pressure to divulge details on outside agitators at campus protests. They talk about it, but they don't mention it. But then I thought this was kind of interesting. You want to know who an outside agitator is? Maybe you should introduce yourself to Speaker Mike Johnson. So I just thought that that was, would he be labeled an outside agitator? I'm not quite so sure. But we are seeing this happening, and not on all the college campuses. Let's realize that there are thousands and thousands of college campuses, and you can go from one, like nothing is happening, for example, you know, at Rhode Island College, but in Brown there is. And then you can go from campus. So then the question becomes, how is this going to be impacting students' engagement and young people's engagement in the November election? Or is the concern not as much about young people as what does it mean for those sort of undeclared independents who are going to be evaluating what they see happening on these college campuses and then making a decision that may not necessarily be totally a straight line, but somehow seeing this unrest and blaming it on Joe Biden?
Absolutely. So starting with what this, I think, is going to do for the people who are part of these protests. So I was on the ground in Portland, Oregon for the entire summer of 2020, all of the BLM protests. I was there from the first night. And I intellectually knew about police brutality before those protests, but there is something very, very different from seeing and feeling it, experiencing it on your own body. It will change your perspective on this country, on police generally, on authoritarianism. And I don't like that this is happening on campuses. I am appalled. I am heartbroken. If there's any silver lining, it is that perhaps the leaders of tomorrow will understand in that intimate way what police violence is. As far as the rest of it, it is very difficult not to look and just be furious at the rank hypocrisy here, because the very same people who were all about the BLM protest of that summer are suddenly all about order. And just it's so very clear to me, and I think to everyone who's looking, that there is no principle here. We are living in an authoritarian zeitgeist where the point is free speech is whatever I like. And if it's not that, then it's disorder and we need to stop it. And it's, I don't know. I feel like, I don't know how people feel. I don't know, but I feel like the two options are just being disgusted or feeling like Biden's not doing enough, because whatever he does, he's only going to ever be the second best authoritarian in the room. You've got people like outside agitator Mike Johnson talking about how he's not doing enough. It doesn't matter what he does. He could send in the National Guard tonight and it would not be enough. What he's doing, aside from being immoral, is electoral suicide, and it's making me crazy.
Well, I think it is a bit of electoral suicide, and I'm going to go to an article. I don't know if I posted this, but Adam, since you also are affiliated with Michigan, I saw a piece at Slate.com from a couple of days ago, and it was entitled, "Are Arabs in Michigan Really Prepared to Hand the Presidency Back to Donald Trump?" That was the question that was asked. And of course, we're talking about Gaza and Hamas, and we're talking about what's happening with the protests, and are you pro-Israel, or are you pro-Palestinian, are you anti-Bibi, what anti-Netanyahu, whatever it is. But listen to this. I wrote, "Bibi will never pursue a ceasefire now. Just wait it out, and his accomplice Trump will ensure that every Palestinian is wiped out, and Netanyahu will achieve what he has always wanted." Here's the quote. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rejected the notion of Palestinian statehood in a news conference about a couple weeks ago, claiming it would endanger the state of Israel. But he also invoked geographical language that had become a point of bitter contention as Israel's continued military bombardment of Gaza continues in response to the Hamas attack, saying in the future, the state of Israel has to control the entire area from the river to the sea. According to an English translation of the speech from Israeli news channel I-24 News. So as I'm looking at this story and how does this play out for young people, I think we don't even need to go there, because if you see places that are so important like the state of Michigan, and if Arabs are really prepared to hand the presidency back to Donald Trump, are they counting bodies? Because if they're worried about the bodies under Joe Biden, they will lose the ability to count the number of dead Palestinians under Trump. And that's just a horrible way of looking at it. But to a large extent, that's what their choice is. And I don't know how you make that choice.
Yeah, so I teach at Michigan remotely, so I'm not on the ground there. I don't know, others will know better than I, you know, how influential that voting bloc is. And I don't know if by November they will, you know, continue to be angry at what's happening now. But yeah, look, I've never understood why it's so difficult for people to keep in their head that, you know, you like to play cowboys and Indians when you're 6 years old and younger, and you have to pick a winner. But there are lots of conflicts in which, you know, there are not fine people on both sides. And I've been called a self-hating Jew for saying I think Israel is on its way, it may already be there, to be a failed state run by a failed Jewish person. You know, being Jewish is very important to my former Cheltenham High School colleague around the same time, Mr. Netanyahu, but he's doing a very poor job of it from my point of view, spiritually and ethically and morally. But I can keep those thoughts in my head and be angry at the anti-Semitism, but regard this as a secular government pretending to be a religious government, doing a very poor job of it. And I have no problem at all saying there are lots of failed states out there on the planet, and that's one of them. And that doesn't make me, you know, an outcast. I think, you know, they're on the wrong side of the tent at this point.
And let me just say something. So Stephen, as I'm listening to Adam, again, I see this as sort of a continuation of what exactly the Republicans want to accomplish. You know, they want to destroy higher education. And this is sort of almost fitting in. The protests are not about protests. It's just adding, as I pointed, the icing on the cake. They go after CRT. They go after DEI. They ban books. They ban faculty. And now what do they have? Now they have Mike Johnson suddenly rolling into the Columbia campus, you know, talking about these agitators and wanting to bring in the National Guard. I mean, they're not about caring about public education. They're not caring about free speech. They're figuring out every way, shape, or form that they can basically undermine whether it's public education or higher education in America. And to a large extent, I feel scared because I feel like they're being incredibly successful.
I you know, I think to state what I hope is obvious to most folks is that to identify the current Republican congressional leadership as concerned about anti-Semitism is delusional. And yes. Likewise, to read their concern about the access to good education on higher education institutions in the United States also would mark one as delusional. I want, if you'll indulge me, Artie, I want to step back just a little bit. Please. Because I've been trying to think about what's going on in historical context. And I think there are two basic truths that we've got to recognize are always in tension. One is that for my money, mass disruptive protest is at the heart of every social and political gain that we as a country have made throughout our history. That's thing one. Thing two is that when it's happening, disruptive mass protest is wildly unpopular. Only in retrospect do people align themselves as supporting it, right? Keep in mind that at the time of his assassination, Martin Luther King's approval rating was approximately 20 or 25%. Right, that in 1961, polls about the sit-ins at lunch counters in the South showed upwards of two-thirds of all Americans in opposition to one of that most basic tactics of the civil rights movement. And yet, going back to my first point, right, we can go all the way back to the Boston Tea Party, right, and the destruction of property. That is one of the seminal moments that led to the revolution itself, right? John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, right? Seizing of the Arnable, incredibly bloody act, right? Along with any number of things, helped propel the abolition movement to power and moved us toward resolution and abolition of slavery, right? The Stonewall Riot, that is the founding moment of the modern gay rights movement, right? Culminating in drag queens and others throwing beer bottles and bricks at police, turning over paddy wagons and slashing the tires, right? Derided on the front page of every New York newspaper at the time as dangerous and unseemly and not how it is that we are supposed to engage in changing policy. You get the idea. I could go on for an hour or two with examples, right? So there is nothing unusual here in this regard. The critiques of the current movement, right? Protests are always messy. They're always inchoate. They always attract, especially ones that gain any kind of size, all kinds of different people with all kinds of different perspectives, with all kinds of different agendas, right? Remember the complaints about all of the different or incoherent claims being made by the Occupy movements, right? This is normal, the critiques that we're seeing here. So there's nothing unusual there. Last point I want to make. We have, in that context, in the United States, an exceptionally long history of using state power to suppress those movements, right? One of the common explanations for why the United States has a weaker labor movement and weaker worker power than in other rich democracies is that we suppressed it with force in ways that other nations in the 1830s in Britain or in the later Gilded Age in other places did not. We have a uniquely violent means by which we use government to suppress populist activity. Goes very much against sort of the story we tell about who we are. Only in retrospect do we point to those movements as something to celebrate. We are now sitting in the present, and it should not be surprising that people are in opposition. They will claim to have supported them 20 years down the road.
So I want to turn to you, Lincoln, because I know you want to weigh in here. But one of the things that I found very interesting was, you know, how to approach what's happening on college campuses. And again, you look at the leadership and you ask, you know, how did this president respond? How did that president respond? Who invited in the National Guard? Who invited in the police? How quickly did they do that? What kind of negotiation did they actually encourage between both the administration and those that were occupying the campuses? And there was an interesting story that Alex Salmon told us from Slate.com. And that is that not that the president and Brown had done everything perfectly. There had been a lot of arrests at Brown. But you know what they did? They sat down and talked to the students and they agreed to a vote on divestment in the fall. They said, what would you like to do? And they said, we would like the Brown to divest from companies that are supporting what is going on right now in Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians. And what was so interesting about the conversation that I was told by Alex is not only did they agree to a vote in the fall, but they used a document to evaluate companies based on a document that was created in 2020 by an organization of corporate responsibility. So it wasn't like someone like just handpicked whatever. And yet, as soon as they did that, guess what happened? It disbanded on the Brown campus. And they didn't get what they wanted, but they got a vote, which is what they wanted. At least that start. So again, there are ways of approaching it. But then you begin to look at what's happened, and so many of these presidents are reacting to the fear of what they saw happen before Congress, or the fear of some of their board of directors, that they're actually creating more havoc than stability.
There's a lot here, and I'm going to try to get to some of it. The demand for divestment, I mean, I don't know if the university administrators are aware of this, but they've already lost. The protesters have already won. It may not happen tomorrow or the next day, but within 5 or 10 years, I think it's almost inevitable. Part of that, I want to go back to something Adam said, why I think it's inevitable. But I want to stress something else. It's not the divestment that, I mean, I don't have a problem with that. Severing academic ties with Israel. If you are a major research university, you are going to lose many of your top people. You are therefore not going to attract many top students. That is a real thing. As much as everyone hates the Israeli government and most people hate Israel, the amount, it is a major intellectual center in the sciences, in the social sciences, in the humanities. And we do not cut academic ties with other countries based on the horrific actions of their government. So that is something to note. I know I have colleagues who would leave universities and leave Columbia, and I suspect that other universities would be happy to have them and their $10 million grants. Not to be too self-centered, but there are universities who would like to have my decades of fantastic teacher evaluations because I wouldn't teach at a university like that decided that we're not going to work with other Jewish intellectuals. The other point here goes to Adam is that that's all moot because Israel is on the road to being a failed state. And that was true on October 6th of 2023. It is not because of this war.
Yes.
And if Israel continues down that path, and becomes, and I'm paraphrasing a couple of articles in Haaretz, these are not my words, but a theocracy, a Jewish Iran, which is where it is going, unless there are dramatic changes, then every, not only does everything, every potentially pro-Israel argument fall apart, but Jewish support here in the United States throws up their hands and says, you know, this government attacks us, they don't consider me Jewish, I don't want a part of this. Not for nothing, the Jewish population is declining here in the United States. One of the biggest differences on college campuses between the generation of students now and when I'm in my mid-50s, when I was a student, and this is not just on elite campuses like Columbia, because I didn't go to an elite school, is that these schools are much less Jewish. There are many fewer Jews from faculty to students and many more Muslims. I typically have more Muslims than Jews in my class. That was never the case when I was a student. It's a funny thing, but when I use a Yiddish word, my students don't understand it, right? They are much less Jewish spaces. The country is becoming much less Jewish, and for all kinds of reasons, the colleges and universities are. Now, I want to raise something about this issue about the electoral impact of this. I'm going to start with this. If every Muslim voter in America, particularly, let's say every Arab voter in America, and this is probably true of all Muslims, who voted for Biden switched their vote for Trump, it would not change a single state. Okay? There are, and I can walk you through the numbers, but that is simply the case. Now, the reason that is relevant here is that this is not about Muslims. It's about white young people. Their votes, they outnumber Muslims. They can make a difference. If you put those two groups together, this election can easily go to Trump. But there's another piece to it, too, and this is going to be my penultimate point, is that this has pushed away swing voters who now see what the Republicans will describe as chaos, as opposed to what I might describe as excessive state violence, and push them back to Trump. That is how Trump can win. And do you know who will get the blame? Do you know who will get the blame despite probably continuing to vote 70% for Trump? The Jews. That is the nightmare for me, and that is very likely. But I want to add one more thing, because you said something, Arnie, that I agree completely, which is what a Trump election means for the Palestinian people is devastating. The problem is this. The problem is this. Once you convince yourself that what is occurring in Gaza is a genocide, and to be clear, if you take the Hamas numbers, a 6-to-1 civilian to military ratio in response to a military attack has never been considered genocide before, right? Genocide talks about destroying a group. And if you look at the number of Palestinian people, these are not ratios that begin to be part of the genocide conversation in other contexts. But once, it doesn't mean it's not an atrocity. It doesn't mean it's not murderous, terrible, stupid, horrible, violent, excessive. But if we use the definition of genocide that we apply all over the world, this doesn't qualify. But once you believe this is genocide, then you say, of course, it doesn't matter who's in the White House. Of course, it doesn't matter if I burn my university to the ground. And that's the problem. And that's the extent to which on the left and on university campuses, it is a consensus by people who've never studied comparative genocide, who don't know. I mean, there was no, I've studied what happened in Rwanda, and there was no attempt to say, oh, let's broker a ceasefire, but we won't do it because we don't release enough of our people, right? This is the Tutsi saying that. But once you accept that, then it doesn't matter who's the president of the United States. And that's the problem. So this is very, very good week for Donald Trump.
So Laura, I was sort of talking about counting the dead bodies, but I am going to be honest with you. When I think of Donald Trump, I'm not just looking at the fact that it'll be a license to wipe out everyone in Gaza, which is a number of people within Netanyahu's government that actually want to do that. That's what they want to do. They've said it on the record. But at the same time, I am looking at what Donald Trump will mean for public health, what Donald Trump will mean for women, obviously women's health, what Donald Trump will mean with fighting the climate. Literally, if you elect Donald Trump, you can actually start evaluating a Trump versus Biden, and you don't have to just go to what's happening in Gaza. You can literally go across the board in everything he embraces, and death becomes part of the solution. because that's ultimately what he is doing. And you will not have accomplished economic stability. You will not have accomplished looking forward. You will not have done anything. Not only will he basically make sure that there will never be another election, but I am telling you, you need to start counting the bodies. And the bodies aren't just about what's going on in Gaza.
I agree. I plan to vote for Biden in November. It's impossible for me to imagine anything that would change my mind on that. I will say, I think people are very tired of being held hostage. I'm not saying this is rational, but I understand the feeling. Yeah. People are very, very tired of being told that their only option is to vote for Biden, no matter what he does, no matter what he does, because Trump is worse. And even though that's true, it's very upsetting. And I think people are tired of it. And one response to being tired of it, not a good response, but a response that is understandable, is what I'm euphemistically going to call the screw it button. You just hit the screw it button, like, I don't care, let it all burn down, I'm sick of this crap. And I think that's how Trump won in 2016. A lot of people hit the screw it button. They didn't like that Hillary was the candidate. They felt like there was some shenanigans in the Democratic primaries. She's just not popular. And people were like, screw it. Why not go for the weirdo? Why not go for the outsider? He's not going to win, whatever. Screw it button. It's a little different this time, but I do think that if enough people hit it, we're in real trouble. And I do think if enough people hit it, the Biden campaign should look in the
mirror. Let me just stop you there. Because here's the problem with screw it 2016 and screw it 2024. In screw it 2024, you've got Project 2025, that 900-page tome. In screw it 2024, you have the experience of Donald Trump for 4 years. In screw it 2024, what you have now is his interview with Time magazine. You now know with such incredible preciseness and detail how he will hurt you. How he will hurt your family, how he will hurt your daughters, how he will hurt your climate, how he will hurt your job, how he will basically aid and abet the millionaires and screw all the 80% of us who actually have to work for a life. And the difference is it is so precise and it has the target of almost everyone's back. And for you to say screw it is for you to be in such collective denial about what the intent is, because you can't say you don't know, because they have told you in every way, shape, perform, Laura.
Yeah, and it's not burn it down like a forest fire. Sorry.
All right, well, Laura, really quickly, and then Adam.
The problem is, first of all, a lot of people don't know. A lot of people don't know about Project 2025, the 900-page tome thing. It's a real problem. They're not news junkies like we are. They don't know. And the second thing is, it's not rational. People are not always rational. And when they get driven to extremes of emotion, which is happening right now, they can do some real crazy stuff. And I am not sanctioning it. Like I said, I am voting for Biden. If you're listening to this, please vote for Biden. I understand why you're upset, but please vote for Biden. All I'm saying is, like, the reality of the situation is people are very upset, and sometimes people do crazy things.
Okay, 2 minutes, Adam. Yes?
I was just going to say, I love the metaphor, but it's not burn it down like a forest fire out of which comes new growth. I haven't read more than 1% of that 900-page tome, but oh my God, it's the billion chimpanzees and Hamlet is not coming out of those typewriters. But it's burning down our ability to even regroup and restart the American experiment at the end of the next 4 years. It is so awful and so sick. There's really no other word to describe it. So I appreciate the anointed candidate problem, but no, this is DEFCON 5.
Well, and Stephen Pimper, if people don't know it, that's our job. That's our job. I mean, I know how to tell people how to teach them. I'll teach them with a billboard. I'll teach them with a PSA. I'll teach them at the Dunkin' Donuts. I mean, the fact of the matter is that you make the assumption that you have to be a news junkie. This is about survival. I mean, Stephen, how can we not explain it to them? Because it's about their very survival and they are the target.
And, you know, I think part of the problem is that we have so much invested the presidency with more attention, power, and rhetorical power than it should possess.
Exactly.
And we don't sufficiently devote our attention to educating people about the entirety of the system and how it functions and how it fails to function and the ways in which your limited choices, and I am right there 100%, they are terrible, but we're lodged in this particular place where that's all we've got. How you convince people that settling for the worst of two bad options is a really uphill slog, but that's part of the task.
And on that note, this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. I want to thank the following individuals for joining our Rethink the Week: Professor Adam Finkel, Lincoln Mitchell, Laura Jadid, and Professor Stephen Pimper. Again, thank you so much for doing this. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao.